This September marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of John Cage, generally considered one of the leading composers of the 20th century. Although he was already an accomplished artist in the 1950s, Cage found strength and liberation through the practice of Zen Buddhism, a conversion he made after attending some of D.T. Suzuki's lectures in 1950. Kay Larson, who was the art critic for New York Magazine for nearly 15 years, has written about the composer's philosophical awakening in Where the Heart Beats, John Cage, Zen Buddhism, and the Inner Life of Artists. It's published by the Penguin Press and brings Kay Larson to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, many people, if you say John Cage, the first thing they think of is 433. Can you describe the premiere of that in Woodstock in 1952?
Yes, it happened very close to where I live now. And David Tudor walked across a low stage to the piano, sat down at the piano, shut the piano lid so that, in effect, he couldn't play the piano, set up a stopwatch, and then sat there without moving for an interval of time, and then there were three intervals like that at the end of the whole performance, which lasted 4 minutes and 33 seconds,
plus exactly
whatever time it took him to switch gears. He got up and walked off stage.
And what was the audience reaction?
Well, at least some of the audience was apoplectic.
But most probably understood what was going on.
No, I don't think anybody understood. In fact, I'm going to be bold enough to say that I don't think anybody has really understood that piece until I started looking at it from the point of view of Zen Buddhism.
Oh, really? I just always thought it was about the sounds that we make, and that's kind of music as well. But what are the links between Zen Buddhism and that work?
Well, it is about the sounds of the world around us, which I've been calling the music of the world. Because I think that's a very Cagean point of view. But there's a historical link between what D.T. Suzuki was teaching in his classes at Columbia and the occurrence of the first performance of 433, which happened in August 1952, right after the first full semester of Suzuki's classes.
I would have seen also links to avant-garde movements from early in the 20th century, like Futurism and Dadaism.
Well, Cage had futurist encounters and Dadaist encounters early on in his life, but in this particular case, D.T. Suzuki was teaching something called the Heart Sutra, which is the pith teaching of Mahayana Buddhism, and essentially it says form is emptiness, emptiness is form. So if form is the structure of the piano piece, and emptiness is the silence of non-doing in this piece, you put form together with emptiness, and you get the music of the world.
Although he only did that once. Everything else, actually, we had people playing the instruments. What was his family background?
His family seemed to have conspired to create the John Cage we know. His grandparents, especially his grandfather, was a revivalist minister. Who,
did that lead to his Christian mysticism?
Yes, I think so. Both grandparents were very heavy-duty Christians, and his grandfather tried to move to Utah to convert the Mormons at one point. And Cage's father was an inventor, and his mother, I compared her to Gracie Allen because she had this... She had her own way of looking at things, and it was very funny.
And then he studied with Arnold Schoenberg mm-hmm. at UCLA. Did he compose serial music after that?
There's a long dialogue among musicologists about what Cage learned from Schoenberg, and clearly he learned a lot. And also clearly he rebelled against some of it. Schoenberg was a lasting influence in many ways, but mainly as a foil so that Cage could find what he really cared about.
Well, Cage seemed to be more interested in rhythm than in harmony.
He was actually interested not just in rhythm but in noise, because he'd come across this text by Luigi Russolo, who was a futurist at the time of Marinetti and the first moments of futurism. And Russolo was saying, you know, all these sounds are beautiful in themselves. Everything that we call noise is just a label.
And then there were composers who actually took that to heart and recorded the sounds of water dripping and machines or whatever and mm-hmm. came up with, what is it, musique concrète?
Yes, that's certainly an aspect of this general movement, right?
Now, two other great influences and collaborators were the dancers. Was the dancer Merce Cunningham and painter Robert Rauschenberg? How did Cage meet them?
Merce Cunningham he met in 1938. Cage and his wife Zenya had moved to Seattle to take a job. Cage was taking a job as accompanist for the dance class at the Cornish School, and there were four students, and one of them was this young man called Mercier Cunningham. And I think that Cage and Cunningham probably felt very attracted to each other at that point because they started to perform together.
And the marriage ended, but I would assume that Cage must have been aware of his tendencies.
He had actually had a number of gay encounters, and he lived with a man for a couple of years before he got married. In fact, he was still with the man and still having gay encounters when he got married. So that was pretty interesting. But I think he was trying to, quote-unquote, lead a normal life as it was defined back then. But then he met Merce Cunningham, and just all bets were off. And this was truly a love affair.
So that's before, and then Rauschenberg came in later?
Rauschenberg met Cage certainly by early 1951 or mid-1951, but there's some suggestion that he might have met Cage while they were both at Black Mountain for one reason or another. But Rauschenberg, at the time he met Cage, had just thrown his work in the Arno River and was actually not doing much. He certainly wasn't the Rauschenberg that we think of. And then he met Cage, and as a result of that, I believe, Rauschenberg did the white paintings.
Now, Cage seems to still be struggling with all sorts of problems, including his sexuality, until he comes to Buddhism. What were the problems there? Was it just that he couldn't reconcile the fact that he was gay and wanted to be like everybody else?
Well, there's some element of that, but also his very close friend and his first mentor in music, Henry Cowell, who was a genius in music and who had been extremely important. He published he gave Cage the chance to first perform his first composition. Henry Cowell had been thrown into prison, into San Quentin, in fact, for being involved, so the charge went, with a 17-year-old boy who had apparently been seducing him and who blackmailed him, allegedly. And Cowell had been assigned, you know, this immense prison sentence 2 years before Cage met Merce Cunningham. Also, Cunningham was a student. When Cage met him, he was just beginning his sophomore year. At the end of his sophomore year, he'd go off to New York to start dancing with Martha Graham. Cunningham was very definitely a student, and Cage must have felt an enormous attraction, and yet he must have felt that this was forbidden territory.
My guest is Kay Larson. She's written Where the Heart Beats, John Cage, Zen Buddhism, and the Inner Life of Artists. It's published by the Penguin Press, and this is really not a straight biography. This is really a look at how things influence an artist and how an artist approaches things. Obviously, in the case of Cage, he was always attracted to Eastern philosophies, even before Zen came along, although when he was on our show some years back, 1988, in fact, I asked him about the appeal of Zen Buddhism, and this is what he said.
I became involved with Oriental philosophy, and particularly with Zen Buddhism. And one of the principles there that seems to be also in the present concern with chaos from a scientific point of view is the response to the notion of cause and effect. And I don't know just where it's said, but it's said that everything causes everything else. So we don't speak of cause and effect.
This was at the time when chaos theory was really in the air. But it sounds to me like he came across Zen Buddhism and it just fulfilled it answered all of the questions that he was trying to have answered. Was he already a famous composer at this point?
He was very well known, and he'd had a concert at the Museum of Modern Art, and his music was being heard, but he was not yet the radical John Cage, the one who invented all these new forms that have so thoroughly changed the whole of arts culture, not just music, but also visual art, performance, dance, all kinds of art forms. And each of those, if you look at his history with D.T. Suzuki, you can see the origins of each of these in what Suzuki was teaching, including that quote.
Well, the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism are an acknowledgement of a way out of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And was that important to him? Was he suffering?
Oh, absolutely. He was suffering this nightmare of not being able to resolve his feelings for Cunningham while his marriage was dissolving, and also Cage's own judgments about himself, I feel. And he walked into Suzuki's class, and Suzuki said to him, essentially, you're all right the way you are. You're just fine. So what are you worried about? And Cage got to see himself creating judgments in his own mind.
Now, he was attracted to Zen Buddhism, not Tibetan Buddhism, because Zen Buddhism also incorporates the idea of irrationality.
Well, Tibetan Buddhism didn't really show up in the United States until 1976 when Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche created a center here.
Is that where you became connected to Buddhism?
No, I actually practiced at Zen Mountain Monastery, which is a Zen monastery in Mount Tremper. I did that for 10 years, and then I had a kind of awakening moment myself, and I went to the other side of Woodstock where there's a Tibetan monastery.
Was Buddhism what first drew you to Cage as a subject?
Well, you know, I'd been carrying around Cage's book Silence for a couple of decades, and not quite knowing what to do with it because I kept reading it and not understanding the undertone. But then I got to Zen and I said, oh, man, that's what he's doing. He's talking about Zen. It informed his entire path.
Well, he also, later in his life, became a painter. Not surprising, Arnold Schoenberg was a rather accomplished painter. But was that the connection for you as well?
Actually,
had you written about music and dance? Or, as far as I remember, you pretty much concentrated on the visual arts.
Well, you know, I've been involved with all the avant-gardes for a really long time since I was in a happening in the 1960s when I was in college. And I've, through visual art, which has all these performative elements, installations, all kinds of sound art, sound installations, all kinds of forms come in close contact with visual art.
Part of the practice of Buddhism is to rid oneself of the ego, but doesn't an artist like Cage have to have a huge ego to create the type of art and music he produced?
Of course. Everybody has an ego and nobody can get rid of it. There's this illusion that you can somehow empty yourself out and open the trash bin and dump your ego. You can't do it. The whole point in Buddhism is to see how you're creating these thoughts and to realize you don't have to create them and you don't have to believe in the judgments you create. You just see them for what they are, as these ephemeral forms. And once you see them as ephemeral, then you don't have to attach. And that's where the suffering comes from, is attaching. Mm-hmm. When you stop attaching, you don't have to believe yourself anymore. And then there you come in contact with other parts of your own wisdom. And that wisdom is what informed Cage.
And do you think that he resolved all of those problems later in his life?
Oh, that's where Cage began to smile. You can historically see it in his photographs.
Kay Larson's book, Where the Heart Beats, John Cage, Zen Buddhism and the Inner Life of Artists, is published by the Penguin Press. We decided to play something where a musician is actually playing rather than the 4 minutes 33 where you don't hear anything to go out with. Thank you so much, Kay.